So you're probably aware that the term genome is the common term that's used to describe all of the DNA that you have in all of your cells and in your body. So you inherit 23 chromosomes from your mother and 23 chromosomes from your father, and chromosomes are made of DNA. So what our laboratory does is we study the structure and the sequence of DNA and try to find how differences or variations in those DNA sequences either cause or provide risk or susceptibility to particular diseases. We know that there's something on the order of 6,500 genetic diseases, ranging from things like cystic fibrosis, for example. This is a disease that's caused by a single gene, to things like diabetes. This is a disease that can be caused by many, many different genes, and lots of things in between. My laboratory in particular studies the genetics of autism spectrum disorder, which is a neurodevelopmental disorder. And we've been developing new technologies to scan the DNA sequences to look for specific variations and how they contribute to how a disease might develop.
So you called it autistic spectrum disorder. Does that mean that there's a number of different factors or a number of different genes that might be involved in causing that?
Yes, the current understanding of autism spectrum disorder is that it's really a grouping of different syndromes, different disorders, and for each of these there may be different genes or genetic events that are contributing. Recently, our laboratory discovered that there were what we call copy number variations of genes, and I'll explain that in a moment, but that probably account for up to 10% of autism spectrum disorder. So in 2004, our laboratory discovered that something new, that previously we thought that all of the genes we had were present essentially in two copies. You would inherit one copy from your mother and one copy from your father. But using some new technologies that allowed us to look at the DNA sequences at a much higher resolution, we found that that's not always the case. In fact, in many instances, some genes are present in only one copy, or they may be present in, say, three copies or no copies. And when we looked at the DNA of autistic individuals in about 10% of those individuals from Canada that we studied, we found that they had these specific copy number variations, and they were involving genes that are involved in how brain cells or neurons communicate with each other. So this is a very exciting finding, because for the first time now we have a mechanism to explain some of autism. I indicated about 10%. And by knowing the genes, we can start to unravel the complexities of what's actually leading to autism.
Does it mean then that your genes actually, there's a change or an evolution that goes on within a person's lifetime? Or is it just the way you're born with it, that's the way it's going to be?
This is a very good question. Maybe I'll just backstep a little on the autism story and then come to answer your question specifically. We know that genes are involved in autism because when you look at identical twins, so identical twins have the exact same genomes. Okay, they essentially have the same DNA. If you look at one identical twin, if that twin is autistic, in over 90% of cases, the other monozygotic or identical twin will also be on the autism spectrum. So that's the first indication that genes are involved. Your question about these copy number variations, they occur in everybody. Everybody in the human population has copy number variations. And in fact, we've now shown that this is the most common type of genetic variation in the human genome. So these changes occur all of the time. And in some cases, they're inherited. In other cases, they're specific to a developing child. And if the changes occur in genes, then they can have different effects. So in some cases, a change in copy number of a gene going from the typical two copies to one copy may lead you to have brown hair, for example, or blue eyes. In other cases, if it hits a gene that's involved in very early development of the brain, for example, it may lead to autism or schizophrenia or something like this. So it really depends on which part of the genome and which genes are actually involved. So I think it's really important to note that the discovery of these types of copy number variations, these type of DNA changes, is very important because it happens in all of us, and at least in these 10% of cases of autism, there's no blame on the families. It's a genetic roll of the dice, and in their children, unfortunately, these changes hit very critical genes involved in development, whereas in other kids who are born without autism, they may have hit other genes that are doing other things. We've now found that copy number variations are involved in many different types of disorders. In fact, we pretty much show that they're involved in almost all different types of genetic diseases. So it really just depends on the luck of the draw, for lack of a better term.
Well, does that mean then that you can do intervention?
First of all, this is a very new discovery. We first published our data on the link to autism about a year ago, and we had a paper that came out earlier this year that has been kind of a seminal study that others are following. It does mean that in those 10% of cases, and we think that number will go up, as we look at more and more individuals, we can identify that individual may develop autism or is at increased risk. And depending on the genes that's involved, we can be more predictive or not. We're still working out the statistics on this. But yes, so the answer is in many instances, we will be, if we can look at the DNA using these new technologies early on, we can identify individuals who would be at an increased risk of becoming autistic. So this may lead to earlier interventions, which, of course, are better outcomes are linked to earlier interventions. So this is part of the plan, yes.
Well, the technology dealing with how we identify genomes and DNA has advanced so quickly since the Human Genome Project was first done. Now people can buy off-the-shelf DNA kits and send away to find out what their heritage is, or maybe get more of an indication of diseases like rheumatoid arthritis or whatever that they might be susceptible to. What does that mean for you as a researcher when it becomes sort of more available to the public to deal with these things?
So maybe I can just give you an update of where the technology stands. The Human Genome Project was an initiative that was international. It took about 15 years to complete. It cost about $3 billion, and that led to a so-called consensus sequence of DNA from many different individuals that was then merged into a reference DNA sequence that we all use and compare and contrast against. In the fall of last year, Craig Venter's group in the United States, he's a very famous geneticist who worked at Celera Genomics, and they had their own version of the human genome sequence. He published his own genome DNA sequence, and our laboratory actually worked with him, his group, on that project. So his was the first genome sequence of an identified individual. That cost about $70 million. And then this year, there's been a few papers that have shown you can do essentially the same thing for about, depending on the study, $100,000 to $1 million. And everyone in the community is quite convinced that you'll be able to do this for less than $1,000 in the next 5 years. There are interim technologies called gene chips or microarrays where you can do just what you mentioned, scan your DNA to generate a fingerprint with a million or so different sites of your DNA analyzed. These cost a few hundred dollars, and you can do this now. There are so-called direct-to-consumer genetic testing companies that will do this for you. And then they compare your DNA profile to published medical literature that has looked at other individuals who have specific diseases, and then they can they attempt to predict risk that you will, based on your genetic profile, develop specific diseases. So how society decides to use this information is really like any other decision. I think what I would point out is genetic information is unique in that I see it as actually the most complete and most powerful type of information, because it's the only type of information I know of that provides insight into your past, your present, and your future. By definition, because you inherit your genes, your DNA from your parents, and they inherit from their parents, it's really a snapshot of your ancestry. So you can trace your lineages based on the DNA sequences, it tells you a little bit about your present, because you know, your genes influence how you're existing at the current time. And in some cases, for late onset disease like Huntington's disease or Parkinson's, for example, if you carry mutations in the genes at least lead to these diseases, you know, and you can identify them now, you can be predictive of your medical health in the years to come. So the other point to make is genetic information, again, by definition, if you look at your own DNA sequence, it also gives you a kind of a snapshot of what your brothers and sisters and parents look like, right? Because you share your chromosomes and genes in part with each of them. So there are ethical considerations. You know, if you have a specific gene, you have a test done, you find out you're a carrier or you're going to develop a disease, that data may also be relevant to your siblings, and you know, who controls that, who should know that information. So these are, I guess, some special considerations. My own personal opinion is that this is really the ultimate form of information that you can have about yourself. When you go to the doctor, they'll ask you things like, you know, do you have a record or a family history of having a specific disease? This is actually the most important information they can get from you. And then they accompany things like images, imaging, diagnostic tests, etc. So I think in the future, having your genetic information, taking it to the doctor with you, will be an incredible resource to hang your medical health records on, to be predictive, to help refine, help maybe pinpoint certain diagnoses. And I think that's the way it will be used. It's not going to be, you know, in some cases it will give you a definitive answer, but in most cases it won't. But it will give you some information of how you might weight certain decisions that you have to make throughout your lifetime.
So where do you see it going from here?
Well, you know, we talk a lot about the technology will win the day. If the price for a genome sequence comes into the $100 range, $500 is probably still too expensive. Thousand, but if it comes into the $100 range, it's almost it becomes a commodity, and I really think that it will over time, and we're not ready yet, but perhaps when, you know, a child is born, they take a blood spot and they will also determine the DNA sequence, and then the family and eventually that child, when the child becomes an adult, will use that information again as an information source to help guide decisions throughout their lifetime. In some cases it will be which drugs to take, for example, not only which drugs, but perhaps which doses of drugs to predict the risk for certain diseases. So you might modify your environment or your diet. But again, it's an information source to assist decisions. It could very well be that this becomes a standard. With every child that's born, you would get a genome sequence done.
Thank you very much, Dr. Scheer.
Thank you.